You're get that hair ready. Jonathan,
A little more.
Todd. Actually, Todd, you introduced me to Nicholas.
Yeah. Hey, Nico, how are you, buddy?
Good to see you, Todd.
And Jonathan, you should know Todd.
Yeah, same here.
Do you know Jonathan Pirelli? Jonathan runs, he's got Steve Case and others coming. He's in Virginia. He runs an event called Distilled Intelligence in October, where they it's basically a venture contest of sorts, but over 4 days.
Oh, wow.
Since it's Baltimore and Virginia are not exactly next to each other, but they're not too far away either.
Where in Virginia do you do it?
We have it at Lansdowne Resort. It's 2.5 days, October 14th, 15th, and it's a $1 million pitch competition. 50 companies compete for that 50 or later stage coming to network, and then we have a forum that we put a dozen people in each group into that are it's similar to a Tiger 21 or YPO for 2.5 days. So it's a great event. Our first fund found all of our best investments through our pitch event, so that's why we continue to do it.
Wow, congratulations. How does one get involved?
Distilledintelligence.com. Investors can buy tickets. Service providers can buy much more expensive tickets. We have our judges lined up. We've got, as Mark mentioned, Steve Case, Brad Feld, and a number of other speakers, as well.
If you're lucky, you could get Todd. But he the last thing he needs is another commitment.
Well, I'm sorry, what were the dates again? October 13th?
14 and 15. Yeah, the 16th is the day we announce the winners and have the big checks people will hold up, and we call it deal day. A lot of deals get done if there are allocations available at our events. But Todd, I'd love to talk with you offline if it makes sense for you. If you're in Baltimore, it's one night, maybe two at our at the event. I guarantee you'd have some great interest, co-investors to meet, et cetera.
Great. Let's maybe Mark, you can connect the two of us.
Yeah, maybe Jonathan, you can also put it in that in the link
Or
in the
just put it
chat.
in the chat.
Put it in
Hi,
there.
Stephen. Good morning. Is anyone here involved in Bitcoin staking
Oh,
or
wow.
know what it
So
is?
we do Bitcoin, Mark, but we
Don't put
don't
your
do
hands up right away.
staking. Yep.
Okay, well, that's what Stephen does. And who needs an energy drink that releases slowly without giving you that quick high and you have fatigue?
I'll take one,
Scott,
Mark.
put one of your drink. You'll take one of those? Okay. Actually, Scott, you should be a sponsor at Jonathan's event in October. Bring a bunch of your Odyssey Elixir. It's better for them.
It'll be great. We actually doing a lot of different events, and they're going
He's in
over really, really
10,000
well.
10, stores and growing. Great.
That's right.
And turned out my daughter, I think, had your stuff at Ohio State at her sorority, so you've already penetrated the Ohio State sorority system.
We do well in Ohio, because we're in Kroger in Ohio. So like, and now we just did that all that Costco stuff in Ohio. But Ohio's great, and yeah, we did a bunch there. I got to get her the drinks. What So anyway, but thanks a lot,
I
Mark.
gave you the address.
Great. Yeah, I got them being sent out already.
Perfect. All right. I put a note in the chat. I was inspired by my little daughter, actually, the one that took guitar lessons from Tate, Todd. She
All
came in
right.
quietly, sat on my lap, and I remembered our first Zooms, and she would, like Kramer and Seinfeld, just like slam through the door and jump on my lap when she was three.
My
And
God.
so I woke up nostalgic with that post I put in the
I
manuscript.
imagine.
Well, I want to talk about what we're doing, and but I also by let people introduce themselves who are new. No one's completely new. But anyone feel new? I will say this, Todd, you've put on a great show, you and Kitty and the whole crew in Newport last week, and your interview of Alan Patricoff was, you know, it should have been like, I don't know, like on Bloomberg. You know, I don't know, it really needed to be, it needs to be here as well. I'd love to get replicate that at some point.
We could do that. And I really think you and I and Kitty ought to talk about merging together next year up in Newport.
That'd be great. And I was talking about you with we have a new podcast series coming on, and you actually are our number one candidate. So we're going to be coming back to you on that, too.
Uh-oh. So I can tell stories about Nicholas.
Oh, my God.
Actually, Nicholas, why don't you introduce yourself? That would be great.
I live in London. I've done a number of startups, exited them all. The last one we exited for $1.2 billion. It was a big travel company. It took us 10 years to get to one point something in revenues, billion. But I now do most of my time is spent on non-for-profit things, but the other 50% is spent on advisory. We advise startups and large corporations, basically because we know what a startup is as an animal. And I recently came back from India giving an award to the Dalai Lama as part of our non-for-profit stuff. Todd was invited because he's a board member of Gold Mercury. But I'd love to share more of these stories with you guys.
Fascinating. Nicholas is a fascinating guy, and he also, his wife is the number one women's swimsuit manufacturer in the world.
Uh-huh.
Yes, we make we're the largest private swimwear company in the world. Independent.
Well, that's
luxury as a luxury brand. It's called Melissa Odebash.
That's awesome. You have lots of fun facts. Nicholas, I mean, who else has interviewed the Dalai Lama? Anyone?
Yeah, you can see the mask behind me. That's one of the gifts from the Dalai Lama. It's supposed to protect me.
Yeah. It does it?
It's protecting me, yeah, from Todd.
anyone else new? I guess Malia Bengali, just by tradition, you know, 10, 15 seconds who you are. You don't have to have interviewed the Dalai Lama.
Hi, thank you for having me on. Kira just told me that she introduced me here. Thank you, Mark, for having me on. Lovely to meet everyone.
A little about yourself.
My background is I launched and run a commodity equity relative value macro arbitrage fund. We launched in the U.S. last year. It's focusing on all the basic resources, energy, mining companies. We look at things from a macro perspective. It's based on the physical market arbitrage into the financial market. My background is basically I ran this fund at Goldman's, UBS, and Merrill Lynch, and this is mostly a vehicle for retail investors to get access to commodities because in the new paradigm of inflation in the market, not many investors have access to commodity ETFs and commodity market exposure.
Sorry, just a quick one, but I get it. You're passionate about what you do, and I think I get some of the gist. But welcome. Didn't mean to cut you off, but I just try to give everybody a quick voice.
Thank you very much.
Anyone else new? Chloe? Actually, you need to get Kira in here, too.
Mark, maybe myself. I can just do an introduction.
Yep.
Hi, I'm Susan Lineke. I've got my company's called The Vestix. So we focus on VCs real estate predominantly. And we also start a company called Banks as a startup, which will be the financial, the Amazon for financial services that we built on chain and with sophisticated AI agencies. Thank you.
That's a nice. What would you call it? The Amazon of what again?
The Amazon for financial services. So everything that will be on-chain from anything financial instruments that you can choose and anything from financial planners, wealth advisors will come onto our platform. Yeah, think of us as the Amazon for all the financial services in the future.
Okay, that's bold. Anyone else new?
No, I'll just say a word. You know, I'm Scott Froman. I'm the CEO and founder of Odyssey, which is a functional energy drink, not a typical energy drink, but a functional energy drink for, you know, more sustainable energy, focus, clarity, mood boosting with better for you ingredients. We're in 10,000 doors. I founded the company just 3 years ago, just got into, you know, and it's becoming like the who's who of the industry. So glad to be part of the group here, Mark. Thanks a lot for inviting me.
We got to meet Scott in the Hamptons. He brought some samples. They were all tasty. And, he's growing. He's looking for partners to help him, you know, get into more retail channel locations and go abroad.
Hey, Scott, have you ever looked at de-alkalized wine and resveratrol?
Yeah, I have. I have looked at that. You know, I think that's really cool. You know, we're really staying in our own lane. You know, there's a whole new movement of, you know, energy. You know, no one's really cracked the code, you know, of energy. You know what I mean? And, you know, it's working. We're really competing against Celsius, Alani Nu. You know, really, like, I don't think Red Bull's going to stand the test of time, but the ingredients just aren't right. We use functional mushrooms, Mayan's main cordyceps, you know, but we're not really focused on a mushroom drink. It's just using the good ingredients to develop the effect, you know.
Second.
So, just a few other things. I don't know who's speaking. Make sure you mute yourself. Probably Walter. Is that you, Walter?
Yes. Sorry.
No, you're good. That makes sense. You want to... Walter's got a whole crew in Seattle at the Rainier Club. I think that's what we should do. Todd, 1 year, you should invite people, you know, to the Annabelle room, the flower room again, and just have them join like Walter does at the Rainier Club. How many people you got gathered with you today, Walter?
Today we've got about 10, 12, 14.
Nice.
I can't see if the – can cool you see –
You got him on blur.
I got him on blur. Technology, right? Let's see. Yo.
Walter, I'll loan you my owl, by the way, for next time.
You just need to change your background because your background's blurred.
Yeah. There you go.
There you go. Got the background blurred.
But this is great. I listened to the introductions. I couldn't make out all the names. If everybody could introduce themselves, but go slowly. Name, company, in one sentence.
You're on.
Susan Weingartner, Cambia Capital.
Speak up, please.
Susan, Jim Sayer. I got her last week, and we're connected, so welcome, Susan.
Thank you. Jim Sayer, retired radiologist.
Walter, is this camera not working?
It works.
It's working.
Is this working here?
Oh. No.
Okay.
Not connected. Walter's lets you connect. Who's the next person?
Will Hicks, Sapling Wealth Management.
Hi, Will.
Sandy Walsh, Luxury Real Estate, Exact Home Team.
Hi, Sandy.
Trevor Cobb, Avantia Family Office.
Hi, Trevor.
Troy Niehaus, Bernstein.
Hi, Troy.
John Richmond, Bernstein.
Hi, John, Bernstein.
Larry Peterson, Shop Tech.
What was the first name?
Larry Peterson.
Larry. Okay. Thank you.
Hello. Chandler Lewis, Adept Ventures.
Chandler. But you were with something that's 360.
Got to.
Yeah. So just so you know, Chandler lives in Brazil.
I know.
He's moving down to Brazil. We're going to be doing some business together. Chandler's actually going to try to hold one of these down in Sao Paulo.
Good.
In Sao Paulo. Good. So we'll have a room full of folks in Sao Paulo as well.
Perfect. Wherever you go, you should do this.
Mm-hmm.
Keep going, Chandler.
Beth Sarugusa, Pure Essentials Energy Consulting.
Excellent.
Merla Wade, S. Merla, Life Elevation Strategist.
What was your first name?
Merla.
Merla. Okay. Hi.
Nicholas White, Finky Brain Training Company.
Excellent.
Doug Cunnington, Cognacore Consultant.
And you're all members of the Rainier Club?
Most.
Where
most
is family for a member?
It's a great club. Maybe 5 seconds on what the Rainier Club was founded when?
1888.
Good year.
Yeah. So Sandy is our chairman of the programs committee. Sandy also happens to be the chair of the wine committee. So that's why we invite her here, hoping that we'll bring in some wine to this breakfast in the future.
Oh, we should. Next time we'll do this 8 o'clock Singapore time.
Yeah.
No better for you. Well, great.
I'm making a movie on Robert Parker, if anybody's interested.
Oh, absolutely.
Tell us, Todd, what's it about?
Well, Robert Parker is the greatest wine critic that ever lived, and he's a very close personal friend. He lives right near me here in Maryland, which is where he is from, and I felt that he needed to be memorialized. So I've made 3 wine movies in the past, a year in Burgundy, a year in Champagne, and a year in Port, and now I'm making this movie on Parker, and I'm raising money if anyone wants to invest.
Have the last 3 made money?
Intriguing. All 3 of them made money. Yep. And that, you know, and this is Robert Parker, so this should do better.
Okay.
Oh, we definitely need to talk. I am on film and we're doing different features about extraordinary men. We call them Papa Lions of America. So anyways, we should chat.
Yeah.
Is the film scripted? Put your email in the chat.
We're doing both. This is a docu-series, but we're doing scripted as well.
Todd, you got your own wine, I think. Like Rupert.
I do, yeah.
There you go. Well, we also have a wine fund. I was just putting, we have a collectibles group. In fact, Kira, we were talking about wines. So Maxwell Nee has a wine fund. They invest in wines, you know, store them for 5 years, and then help them amplify as they go into the restaurant chains that do pretty well after. Just on deals, our pet and beauty and B2C fashion company, Kim Carney talks about the business of pets, consumer. Steven's on here. I put the Bitcoin yield. I want to see what people think about their staking enhancement. So if you have Bitcoin, you may as well use it. And if you're going to buy into Bitcoin, it gives you some extra yield. And then there's a lot of secondaries. Usually don't go into this, but we've been partnering with a group. We're going to do some. And there's a big discounted clean tech company, Series B. It's a recycling of lithium ion batteries with enhancements to it, which is partly a way to deal with the fact that we don't have raw materials. So anyways, so on the deal side, the next, we're in London. I assume, Nicholas, we're only like 1 block away from you. Will you make it this time?
Listen, if you could make it half a block. no, listen. What are the dates?
It's right on the screen there. 18, 19. But I'll
of September.
That's right. It's a Thursday, Friday.
No, of course. I'll put in the calendar. I'll put in the calendar for sure.
Beautiful. All right, so that's you know the basics for us. You know, 361 Digital is in fact, there's a new version of it. Just a quick little glimpse. If you were to see deals, I can't show specific deals. I can show the briefings. I can show, and maybe I can show a deal. It's a way to, instead of reading the briefing, you can see the headlines. So last week, Peter Scheinman was talking about pharma and the status of biotech in China. I think I can show one. Let me just show this. Parth, how you doing? I don't know if everybody knows you either, if you don't mind.
Good, Mark. How are you?
Happy birthday, by the way.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Just a quick intro of yourself.
Yes. Hi, everyone. I'm Parth Vakil, based in Austin, Texas. We're a family office operating between India and the U.S. I lead a lot of our U.S. allocation efforts, and also in the process of building an alternative investments platform for cross-border stuff between India and the U.S.
That's great. And Parth is invested in this company, Lucid, which is a sober sobriety community, but also has a fast-growing sober dating app, which some of you know. And this is an example of what you can see. You know, all I need is the website, and I can create a memo. And then if I can throw on a data source, a deck, or video, or transcript from a video, it automatically populates. And then if I want to ask, who should I consult with, I can click here. And while we have this, the community is small because it's coming out of beta, it tells me and gives me reasons why. So I think that's, and then it's, we're putting this on some steroids. So it's taking its time there. I know they just rolled out the new version about an hour ago. So here are seven peers. In fact, the funny thing is, MJ was on a plane with Anna at an event. That's and if you want to see stakeholders and you want to see what they're all about, you'll soon be able to see all their insights, to the extent which rooms that they're in, if they provided you can provide your opinion anonymously. So if I've consulted on different companies, you know, you can see my review, but I might have liked something, what I viewed, which decision rooms I'm in. Some of these are done by sector. And some you can put your portfolio on here. I'd love to see. I remember one time, Todd, when we first met, you sent me a sampling of your portfolio, but the idea is that you could have your own. I won't click on here, but it's private, so that you can, if you ever wanted to share your portfolio, you know, it's a one-step process.
And right.
So let me pull back. We got a few more minutes. We've had a lot of events around East Coast, Hamptons, Newport. Now everybody's in Hamptons again. What Trump's doing with the Federal Reserve, we'll talk about that in 8 minutes, and other subjects. What other people see in the world that we should be thinking about?
So I can go ahead.
Most definitely, housing prices are. The real estate market is accelerating to the downside. I think we are heading into a collapse in counterparty risk and confidence like we can't even imagine. I think we are heading into 1929.
So has anything happened between the roundtable and the Hamptons until today? Because I know that was your opinion 2 weeks ago.
It's gotten even worse.
Okay.
I mean...
Anybody with a view on real estate? Since real estate's the topic, anyone?
No, I'd love to hear that assumption, if it's based on one or two key things I don't know who was mentioned. Was that Giovanni?
That was Giovanni.
Yes.
Yeah, Giovanni, give me one or two reasons why you think real estate is on that downward.
We have twice as many people who are rescinding their offers to purchase property than we had at the height of the real estate market, the height of the real estate crash in 2009 and 10.
What's your data source for that?
The mortgage banker guy that I introduced you to. Let me make this very clear. The number one mortgage processor for banks. So when a note becomes non-performing, the bank just gives him the note and he figures out cash for keys, foreclosure, short sale, whatever.
To Nicholas's point, can you provide a link of this source that we can review?
I should probably get the guy to come online and you know, some other time and explain his thesis to you.
There are four other hands up, so quick, but we want to run this to ground again. Keith.
Yeah, sorry, I was just trying to scan your QR code to see what it was.
Hey, Teal, I need a QR code for getting on 361 Digital. Let's put that up right now.
But separately, what I'm actually curious about is I met Jim Hurd at your event last month. He introduced me to Bo Varga, and he actually mentioned that some of the government funding initiatives have changed. And so we see a lot in the press about reduction in funding, but there's also some really interesting new sources that maybe we should discuss at some point in time in the future. DARPA has increased, DIU has increased, DIU from $40 million to over $1.4 billion in funding right now. And so it's something that I think we might want to explore as to how to help companies. Thanks.
Mark, maybe we can get the guy from New York in the D. The DIU, Satarsi, remember?
Yep.
So might be helpful in that area.
All right, Adam, and then Zarin, and then Seattle Group, and then we got to launch.
Just a quick commentary to what Giovanni said. And I'm not a real estate guy, but an observation in places like Ocean Reef, which is a very, very high-end, wealthy neighborhood, you're seeing a lot of real estate, a lot of homes going up for sale and on the market longer. And we're seeing that in the Florida Keys, also relatively high-end, an inventory buildup of homes. And these are homes ranging from
let's get the real estate.
$5 million, and then after that, much bigger.
We're going to talk about real estate. I got it. Anecdotal.
That's it.
I mean, anecdotal in Millburn is booming, but you know, I want real data.
If you want real data, you can go to ReVenture Consulting. Just check out ReVenture Consulting.
Put the link in the chat. Let's get to the bottom of it.
I just put a link in the chat box. Like, you know, I think I also saw something in the news yesterday regarding how there are more sellers in the market than buyers right now. So I just put that in the chat box.
Perfect. Thank you, Alvin. Darren, you probably know more about U.S. real estate sitting in Switzerland.
Mark, there's somebody in the group, Susan, who can't raise their hand. That's coming.
I know, Susan. We'll get right.
Actually, that was my point. So because real estate is such a big topic, I understand this is very much U.S.-focused views. But for example, in Europe, especially, I mean, Switzerland, the prices are very high. It's even impossible to find rent. People are doing everything like the rent. Also, some big U.S. companies located to Zurich, some monthly rent skyrocketed to 8,000. Funds are buying, like there's a lot of renovation. So, yeah, I mean, in different parts of the world, different, and maybe commercial real estate and retail and different regions are also different.
They are different. Walter, you got some experts in real estate in your room.
Yeah, so my name is Sandy Walsh. I run the Exact Home team, and for 18 years, what we're seeing right now is inventory levels rising, certainly. In the Seattle area, we have been running for about a decade with about maybe 5 to 10 days supply, and now that is 2.5 to 3 months. Condo market is flat, maybe 8 months supply in that. And what we're also seeing is that there's a perception issue, which is that when you have buyers and sellers alike for more than 10 years, expecting things to sell in 5 days, 7 days. Then when they are taking what's a more normal time frame, anywhere from 30 to 120 days, they feel as though everything has changed and the sky is falling. That's not necessarily the case. A balanced market would be 6 months of supply, and we don't have that except in the condo market. High-end market in Medina, Washington, I was just looking at this yesterday, 4 to 5 months supply, but interestingly, the last 4 years, that's exactly what they've been running. So I think it's a combination of things. Buyers and sellers are both spooked, and we are getting more needed inventory, but yeah, I definitely am seeing things slow down a bit.
Susan, you wanted to – thank you for that. Susan, you wanted to
– Yeah, I'm 35 years, but predominantly focused on commercial real estate, not residential. Residential, I agree, there's a lot of – the market is just double slowdown happening, and I'm talking specifically in the U.S. But for the commercial real estate, it's a very different story. There's a lot of hurt in the office market, multifamily, over the last 4 to 5 years. And what we see happening is that, especially in ground-up developments and in the multifamily, now with the Federal Reserve speculations that the interest rates will come down, the numbers will eventually, if the interest rates come down in the U.S. for the first time in probably 5 years, start making sense, and the numbers will start working out because we all based it on that numbers.
That was Bill. Okay.
Thank
you.
So
look, we hit on real estate.
Right, honey.
In January 2020, Giovanni told us about something called COVID. you can't dismiss anything he says. And there's got to be an ounce, if not a gallon, of truth behind it. But there are a lot of crosswinds for sure. Cross segments, cross markets. So let's get to the bottom of maybe it's a real estate deep dive in the making.
Mark, I think it's going to be one of the hot topics for the midterms as well, housing in the U.S.
Well, Barry Sternlicht told us last week, I think feels like last week, that just the whole multifamily housing starts at being so down from like 400,000, which is even low, to 260,000, I believe, or maybe he was saying it was year to date. I have to go back to data, but that also will drive up rents, which goes again crosswinds. Depends on the markets. Anyone new before we start? Like Alvin, do you mind just introducing yourself?
Absolutely. I think I've been part of the group for about a year now. On and off, I try to attend as much as I can. I'm based out of New York City, have a background in investment banking and family office portfolio management. And last year, I set up my firm called Drawing Board Capital, where we do investment origination for family offices and funds. We also distribute those deals to banks as well. So
welcome.
Good to be here.
Same. Chris Yoyam or Christine, those are somewhat new. Michael, I know you're not new, but you're sitting in London.
Hey.
With the most interesting haircut, so you win.
You know, the business mohawk is still holding strong. I mean, I've made some pretty big changes since I started doing 361. I left my hedge fund towards the end of last year, though I still hold investment there. I have joined a investment bank doing structured lower mid-market, a bunch of special situation. They really needed a tech person, so I got recruited there. And then I'm working with a venture builder pretty aggressively out of UCL, University of City London, and called The Building Blocks. I do a lot of co-investment with them. I was too late to be an LP in their first fund. I will be in their second fund. And
let's talk if you're a free agent. Let's
go. Yeah.
Anyone else new? Otherwise, It's our 281st briefing, and I was telling some people earlier, and you may have seen it in the main WhatsApp chat, that my daughter this morning got up and sat on my lap, and it made me remember the early Zooms. I don't know if anybody was in those early OG days when my little one would just burst in and, you know, and be like this, you know, out of nowhere. We've all had it. She was slowly coming in, and but she wanted a lap hug. So it was making me reflect, first of all, for you, Stephen, you know, 281 in a row. I think you missed two. But it's now we're moving into a new era with 361 Digital. We should have probably should have done it years ago. Now here we are. We had some catalysts, some really interesting way to do it with technology. It's not just join an app like we had. Some of you remember it was the same app that Lady Gaga had. And so I thought it couldn't be all bad. And she had like a million people on it. We got up to 1800, but we couldn't change it. So now we can change anything. And it's great to have a team. I don't know if anybody from that team, they're busy working on the new releases, but yeah, I'm just looking back, looking forward. September 1st is when we'll be, you know, really making it's membership day. So hopefully you'll all be members. And it's not just to join these gatherings, and it's to give you your own AI agent for the community, and we'll interact. And because, like, take for example, just last Michael, you mentioned on the chat with Scott Freuman, you know, who UK distribution for his beverage company. So that should be happening 24/7, not randomly. And it's something a lot of us have talked about. So I'm excited for the future, and excited for this briefing, Stephen.
Thanks, Mark.
Look, someone showed up with a tie in Cincinnati.
Look, true confession. It's the first day of law school, and I'm teaching in 40 minutes.
Okay.
And therefore, I need to look like the teacher as opposed to a student.
Right.
Yes, yes.
And by the way, I was startled to walk across campus and see that the attire for most students is a T-shirt.
That's appalling.
You look good.
You look good.
I'm jealous of the students. thanks, Mark. So I want to reflect on the presentations in Jackson Hole with a focus on Chair Powell, the ECB's Christine Lagarde, and the Bank of Japan's Ueda, and what they had to say about the economy. The theme for the Jackson Hole Symposium was labor markets in transition, and that is certainly the case with immigration, demographics, and tariff, changing terms of trade, all changing dynamics for the labor markets. But there was another theme that carried through the discussion, which was the uniqueness of the current economic conditions and the challenge that this poses for decision makers, whether you're a central banker leading a government fiscal policy or a company or a consumer. Prior to his remarks in Jackson Hole, Chair Powell received a standing ovation from the audience. He also got an extended applause when he finished his remarks, a nod to both central bank independence and also the challenges that the chair has been facing over the last several months as the Fed's been under attack. As you know, I'm a fan of Chair Powell. While he has made some mistakes, I'm not sure people appreciate just how difficult the Fed chair's job actually is. We all have the benefit of hindsight when we're criticizing the decisions that are made. He has to worry not just about the short term, but the long term. And I think that's one of the tensions right now with the administration. But let's take a look at what they had to say and where I think we're going with all this. So he indicated that at his presser of a possible change in the outlook for rate, the Fed funds rate, and we saw now we're back up over 80% on a cut. the market liked what they heard from Chair Powell, I would exercise caution in getting too enthusiastic about it. But the Dow joined the NASDAQ and the S&P at hitting new all-time highs. But so did the markets in Europe, Japan, China, the UK, Australia, and Canada. So for all the worries we have in the world, it's not reflected in the stock markets anywhere. And that may be part of the challenges we see going forward. I think people are getting a little too euphoric about rate cuts. I think what we're benefiting from right now is the rate cuts that have occurred over the last year. People forget that the Fed cut 100 basis points a year ago, and it takes about 12 to 18 months for the flow through to come of monetary policy into the system. And that, I think, is what's carrying not only the U.S., but central banks around the world have also been aggressive in their rate cuts over the last 12 months. But I think the hard part begins now. So Chair Powell described a change in the balance of risk, and he basically said the labor market's okay, but showing some signs of weakness. Inflation has been somewhat elevated, but is down considerably since COVID, and clearly the view of the last mile being a challenge is there. I think what's really created a challenge for policymakers is the tariffs are distorting trade, and immigration policy is distorting the labor market in the U.S. It's also had an impact globally in years past. I think the big issue and where people will get a little thrown off is what can the Fed actually do and what can central bankers do? And they can help with some cyclical issues, but they can't help with everything. You know, we're talking about housing, and while it would be great if rates came down a lot to help housing, you may get a massive increase in inflation in other areas that the benefits of improving housing could have been offset by that. So I think what the Fed's really struggling with is because you've had so many shifts in the global economy and in the U.S. economy, changes in taxing, changes in trade, changes in regulatory policy, that it's gotten harder to figure out what is a short-term versus a long-term shift and what's going to impact short-term and what's going to impact long-term. And I think the other challenge for people to keep in mind, and the Fed chair tried to stress this, is monetary policy can deal with cyclical issues, but they can't solve the secular ones very easily, but they have to be careful not to create new ones. So when they look at the employment market, you know, you see supply and demand pretty imbalanced, but that's because the labor supply is declining at the same time demand is, as we have more people moving out of the system into retirement. I think the jobs revisions have really set the market back a bit. It's become a bigger focus for the Fed than the inflation has, because the view is that the numbers, the revisions came out 2 days after the last Fed decision. If they're out earlier, would the Fed have acted more quickly or not? Probably, but because of the size of the revisions, they would have. But I think we have two more reports to come before we get to the Fed meeting in September. You have two inflation reports and one employment report. And I think the issue for the Fed is inflation has not been trending down lately. It's been kind of creeping up a little bit on their preferred measure. That's not necessarily bad if it stays at these levels, but I think the issue is if they act too aggressively on rate cuts, I think the fear is that you'd see inflation take off. I think the other issue is we don't really know, in spite of what the administration is suggesting, that we're not going to see inflation from the tariffs because we haven't seen it yet. And I think what's happened is companies have not been passing on the full amount of the costs because they don't know what the end game is yet. As we see the goalposts for tariffs keep moving, and Scott Bessin said we might have a clearer view in a couple months, but until we get there, you can't say that we haven't seen, we're not going to get inflation. You can say we haven't seen much come through the system yet. And I think that fear is what's in the back of many of the central bankers' minds right now of how they proceed. So let's shift gears to the ECB and what Christine Lagarde had to say. And her focus was really around demographics, wages, and productivity challenges. And she went back to say, following the Russian energy supply crisis that hit really in the post-pandemic period, there are three conditions that have really contributed to the unusual labor market in Europe that are not normal for Europe. And she compared it back to past periods. And when you look back to the 70s, you had pretty much in the labor union contracts, guaranteed wage increases that occurred really key to inflation more on an annual basis. Fast forward to today, the labor contracts roll multiple year periods without automatic inflation increases that have come out. And what you saw in this period of the post-pandemic, unlike the great financial crisis in the 70s, is real wages dropped right away while productivity increased. And in the past, productivity either moved up or declined while wages continued to move up. And I think that distortion is one of the areas that's messed up the labor market. The other, that's partly a result of the rate the delayed response of wage inflation comes from the way labor contracts are constructed in Europe today. I think you've also seen another factor, which is a reduction of hours worked. And that's led to, and you can see that on the right chart here, on the left chart you see that's companies have started to hoard labor because finding skilled labor is harder today. And if people want to work fewer hours, you need more employees to fill your capacity up. And that's actually led to lower productivity readings for Europe and may lead to that being a sustained problem over time. You add to that two other factors that are different than we've seen in the past is an increase in women and older workers coming into the labor market and an influx of immigrants coming in. And that's been a social and political problem with immigration issues coming in that's led to another distortion of labor markets. But I think this creates a productivity issue which Europe has struggled with for some time. So demographics are a problem in many major economies. Japan's Yoshida highlighted that in his comments. And this chart is fascinating to me because it's a message, an early warning signal for the rest of the world, starting with China, Korea, Europe, and then following with the U.S., of demographic cliff that we're facing. So on the bottom line, you see that's the working age population, 15 to 64, and that peaked in 30 years ago. Think about that for Japan. Their working age population peaked over 30 years ago. Their total population peaked in 08, and they've been in net decline since. That's put great strains on the system at a time that they've had a prolonged period of deflation and no wage increases because they've had no inflation until recently. Japan's one of the outliers in terms of rate increases versus rate decreases from their central bank. And the question is, how far do they go and what does that mean for their system? At a time that they have a real issue of productivity, and they're really, the labor issue is forcing industries to push very heavily into capital investments and substituting capital for labor. And what you can see in the chart on the left is all industries in the dark blue line, but really the industries that most get hurt by low-end labor, which is accommodations, hospitality, retailing, and construction. And that's pushed those areas to increase their software investments, which ironically have not been a great investment in the U.S. this year, but a really interesting dynamic. But I think this pushes back to the topic that's been weighing on the labor markets for some time, is the impact of Gen AI on companies in major economies and their adoption of the technology. And as you can see here, this is from the Bank of Japan's presentation, and Japan is lagging, China's in the lead, the U.S. and Europe are pushing, but this is going to be one of the big areas. We really don't know the impact on employment yet. We do know that there'll be a short-term hit to certain areas and certain jobs, but you'll also see increases in other areas. The real challenge for me in the short term is what happens to our college graduates and low-end workers coming into the system, and where do they go and what's their opportunities, which then bleeds into the areas of how do they get started, how do they get into homes and the like, as we were talking about the housing issues, Mark. So in closing, I think the market liked Powell's remarks. I like generally what they're hearing from central banks around the world, but I think they have to be very careful about this period because we could have a market melt up, which then could lead to a very bad downturn. We could also just see that the next round of reports come out not as favorable as the last for a Fed cut, and the Fed wavers on what they do, or in that meeting, Powell's remarks say, we're going to go on pause for a while, and the market will react negatively to that, I believe, because I think they're priced for perfection now. And I think what the market has to get used to is the fact that this is going to be an earnings market, not a multiple expansion market. We're back to where we were at the beginning of the year with stretch multiples, and we have to see how that plays out. I think the labor market is a big issue. I think the housing market is a big issue in the U.S., and I don't think the Fed can solve those problems easily. I think that some of this has to be worked out over time. I think the demographic issues and productivity are going to be major determinants of who wins and who loses as we move forward. And I think that leaves the U.S. and China in the best spot. I think the resilience of most of the major economies has been pretty fascinating, given how much has been thrown at it in terms of the uncertainty and the challenges. And I list the U.S. here, but it's not just the U.S. How Europe, the UK, Japan, and China have responded has actually been quite impressive. And even Russia managing through their problems has been pretty impressive. But I think what we have to see is what happens next. And I think underlying the stock and bond markets are sending different messages. And I've been one who said that things are pretty sanguine about the changes that have gone on globally, but I am increasingly getting nervous that the U.S. is going too far. And if we don't pull it back and calm things down globally, that we will push nations away from us, and U.S. exceptionalism will be challenged there. And I think things like going after central bank independence and the vendettas that are going on and the retaliation kind of politics that we're seeing today is eroding the trust that has been built up for the U.S. So I think that's an issue that we have to keep in mind, not just as global citizens, but also as investors. I think the last two issues for the market and the winners and losers will be determined by who gets productivity right and who gets immigration right, because that's what's going to drive growth going forward. So, Mark, I'll stop there and open up for questions and comments and challenges.
And good ideas. Thank you, Stephen.
You're welcome.
281 weeks. Any questions for our friend? Walter, or the Seattle Rainier Club, I should say.
Hi, I have a question. So, we were talking about the generative AI improvement gains, and I just wanted to highlight, how do you think that the recent report by MIT that 90% of all generative AI initiatives proved to be of no value? Or I guess the other way you could look at it actually cost money. There were no gains, and they invested a lot of money. And then I would just say, I think the productivity differences that you're comparing with Europe to the U.S. actually has a lot more to do with the happiness index than the actual productivity differences. And that data has been supported by a number of studies that show actually a shorter work week is more productive. And then I think that has additional, inflationary effects as people are.
We got two questions. One about AI and its promise and potential and reality, and the other is European productivity and lifestyle and happiness.
I think I think there will be a lot of money lost in AI, like there was a lot of money lost in the internet in the early stages, and people are going to bet big and lose big, and they're going to bet big and win big, and the winners and losers will be determined by who's solving real problems and who's not. And I think there's been a lot of AI that doesn't solve any problems, and there's going to be a lot of money lost there. I think on the productivity issues, I think there are differences in lifestyle that matter, but I think that, and I think there's a nuance between working a shorter week in productivity versus working too little and still having the productivity. I think there's nuance there, so I'd be careful generalizing in that way. I think Europe has lagged in productivity for a lot of reasons. One is their union contracts are not driven to be productive. They're driven to defend jobs and hold back advances. And we saw that in the U.S. with the port contracts where the port workers didn't want to increase technology, become more efficient to save jobs. And I think that's an issue that we have to resolve by and that's a shift in the union agreements, actually. They put more emphasis on the retired workers, which then becomes lowering productivity as well. So I think it's a very complex issue that you have to be careful generalizing on. So fair question.
We'll keep it going. Zarin, Lucia, Stephen, and Mike.
Yes. Regarding the population and age, I think I do agree with Japan. Yes, there's less children being born. But one of the also calculations is I think now more young people have the ability to grow old. You know, earlier on, a lot of young people died, wars, diseases, and especially, you know, babies. Many people didn't make it, you know, above the age of 5 sometimes, or, you know, mortality in pregnancies. So all right. of that is contributing to the average age increasing, because that's good in a way that more young people are becoming old or are able to become old. Also, that also brings, I guess, the longevity and, you know, maybe working longer, and also the traditional employment with heavy social costs. For example, in Switzerland, it's less heavier compared to the rest of Europe. So, you know, maybe that makes the market sometimes a bit more robust. But I think going forward, there'll be more additional or alternative incomes, secondary incomes, more a bit sometimes so, supplementary things without the heavy costs. So
let's keep it moving, but
yeah,
sure. good points. But Alan Patrikoff, if everybody knows who he is, he ran his 5th New York Marathon at the age of 88. Jack, you got a couple more marathons in you, I think. He also wrote this book. He's focused on investing in longevity. Sort of no surprise, as he enters his 90s. He's been 6 years into it. And I also saw that The Economist had a great interesting article of an older man by the window. I don't know if anybody saw it, but they take care, you know, certain cultures take care of their elder working population.
Mark, that is a problem that Zarin's right on the living longer, but by living longer, it puts greater strains on the government and on the working age population to support them with social, and we're not in a good fiscal position to do that. Globally. I mean, globally.
Yeah.
Right. Thank the you, social Aaron. Safety nets are light.
So I know we're not really answering your question as well as you should be, but it's all these other hands up. Lucia?
Yeah, I just wanted to address a little bit about the AI in terms of workforce. So one of the things that we see is going forward, the workforce is basically going to be AI agents along with individuals. And the productivity issue that you saw in that MIT report is generally because the strategic approach of most people and clients that we even have is that they don't do it from the top down, and it's very siloed, and they want to do a little bit of everything instead of on a more enterprise level. So that's where a lot of the productivity dies. And the trend that we have for our analysts that come in specifically is to get them upskilled to be individuals to understand that going in the future, they will have a robot working with them.
At Accenture, yep. How has your hiring practices been effective?
We basically make the requirement now where we're looking for a bit more technical skills and being able to adapt to a lot of the new technology that's coming. Because solutions, like especially in the generative AI space or the AI space, something that you would have even given to a client 6 months ago is not what you would give them now based on all the changes. So just making sure that they can adapt to that, and then also being flexible to skill up consistently. Like the requirement now is everyone has to be able to build agents, which is interesting considering that homegrown people that did PowerPoints their whole life are having some difficulty with that.
What I do is I merge with an AI company. Stephen, Han.
Hey, Stephen. Good to see you again.
You as well.
A question on the interest rate softening stance. What do you think, how much of a role do you think the fiscal deficit and the interest rates paid on that play a factor into that softening stance relative to the economy, labor, inflation? And if you think it's material, like just curious what you think the negative externalities of having that continue are.
I actually think the debt and deficits are weighing heavily on the decisions that the Fed is making. I think they're worried about the intermediate to longer term while the administration's worried about the short term. I think that's the tension that we're seeing right now, in the markets that, I think they believe that we, just because we haven't seen inflation come through yet, that we might still. And I think that's in the back of their minds, but I don't think it's, prudent for the Fed to, get into that contest right now with the administration because the attacks that they're under with Lisa Cook and the like. So I think they took the path of least resistance. I'm not sure that the, left to their own devices without the pressure that being under that they would be as aggressive in
Stephen,
discussion.
Yep. We went 30 minutes without really hitting this topic. So can we talk about what people think of the grounds are for this action?
Sure.
Am I wading you into these waters?
Listen,
you want to hold on?
I would just say that this is an attack on the Fed that is a remake of the Fed. I think the issue right now is the administration is barreling through with policies and with initiatives that they set out to do at the beginning, and they're not being checked by, haven't been checked by the courts, haven't been checked by Congress, and haven't been checked by the markets yet. So I'm surprised by the reaction of the markets today, the lack of reaction by the markets today. And this is, to me, is a cause for concern. I think where the market's a little too complacent on what's going on. I think whether there's something real or not, usually you wait till there is at least a charge put forth, but this is just accusations right now. So I hope the administration has the stuff to back it up. But I think it's going to drag out. But in the end, I think she's going to go. What it means for Powell, though, is interesting because does Powell stay on for his full term as a Fed governor then is another issue. So I think it's a mess and a sideshow that's not necessary for the U.S. to be going through right now. I think it's a mistake to attack the Fed. But doesn't matter. Good.
Hands are up. Mike, Adam, and Leslie.
Hey, thanks, Mark. On the subject of longevity, congrats on the longevity 8 years and going digital. And Stephen, thanks for your persistence. Also, kudos to Jack Wyant and his future marathons. I don't plan really to work past 85 myself. My one question, I didn't understand what a market melt-up is. Could you elaborate, Stephen?
Yeah, that's when we are at stretch valuations, and it doesn't matter for anybody. They keep investing because they are of the belief that everything keeps going up.
Thank you.
And when you have those, when you have short-term sharp spikes, the come-down is also tends to be short and sharp. So I would suggest that that if you're taking advantage and you're participating in these big abbreviated moves to be prudent, it would be prudent to trim a little bit on the way up and take some profits. So
fair enough.
U.S. equities carefully selected.
Yeah. Adam?
Yes. Thank you, Stephen. I want to ask you about the tensions between the long-term and short-term rates. What is it that the Fed can do to impact the long-term rates? It's clear that the long-term rates are there's a lot of uncertainty because of the debt. What is it that the Fed can do, if anything? That's my question to you.
Not as much, because they were trying to manage rates with their forward guidance, and that's part of the framework discussion changes of how do they manage expectations going forward. I don't think they can do as much on the long end, and I don't think they can do as much on mortgage rates. And that's why they're talking about such dramatic declines in the short end. But, you know, a year ago, September, we cut rates 50 basis points and the reaction was not positive. I think we have to be careful about thinking we're going to be able to be really aggressive in rate cuts and have a good outcome.
Thank you, Stephen.
You're welcome.
Adam, how we got to talk about Miami, October 19th.
Yes, we do. Leslie.
Yeah, hi. Thanks once again, Stephen. Just on the topic of interest rates, to carry on from Adam's point, I recall that there was a move that was made a few months ago to discuss excluding treasuries from bank reserves at some stage this year. It was going to be tabled. Have you heard anything further on that?
Could you repeat the question? I just got distracted. My apologies.
No worries. So when do you think the regulators realistically might move to exclude treasuries from bank reserves? This was something that was discussed around May, June.
Yeah, I think they're going to just, I don't know that they're going to exclude them. I think they reduce, they change the capital requirements on them to make it so that they don't count as risk assets the same way. That gives them more liquidity. I think that I'm not sure if they've already done that or not, to be honest with you. So I have to check. They haven't. I think that's just in their back pocket when they hit a treasury supply issue. Mm-hmm. They deal with it that way.
But yeah, it was talked about by Bessent, but actually, from when I researched it, it's a decision that has to be taken by the Fed. It's outside Treasury's control.
Yeah, the Fed's the regulators, so they would make the decision. But that, I think they're gonna, that's all part of the politicization that's going on right now. So really hard to know.
Okay. I'm wondering if you heard any whispers while you were at Jackson Hole.
No.
Good to put back on the radar, Leslie. Keith?
Stephen, I put this into the chat, but I wanted to ask it here as well. One thing that wasn't clear on the chart you showed about average age was that when did the average age in Japan peak out? Because it's actually a key influencer or driver of certain technologies being adopted in certain markets. So, for instance, in Mexico, the average age of a farmer is 55. The average age of the population is 27. And so I'm monitoring that closely as we enter companies with our products. Because automation, AI, all of that becomes a key driver when the age is younger and they need additional tools and support. So,
Keith, do you
have any data?
I don't have the average.
Stephen, one second. What are the numbers for the U.S., Keith? If that's Mexico.
I don't know, but they're very similar. And for instance, in crop dusters, I think the average age right now is 65. For people who are flying planes over to apply pesticides and other things in Napa and California. So the population in the farming community is spiking.
Yeah.
While the average population is moving out of the farming community, the second generation farmers are moving into tech. And so it's a challenge, but it's a huge opportunity for AI automation and, technology.
Yeah, I don't have the numbers on that, Keith. I really followed the birth death rates more closely, and I look at those mismatches as they come through. And what's really shocking is the when you think back about our whole system, like Social Security was everything that's based on this, the retirement benefits for people, the life expectancies were nowhere near where we are today. I think when the Social Security came out, I think the life expectancy was less than 50. You didn't have the pay-in like we have now, and you have fewer people being born, so that's actually creating the strain on the system. So I think that's really something that we're going to fight for a while.
Yeah, William actually had a good comment in chat if he's still on the call.
Yeah. So I looked it up really quickly. It is interesting. The median age of the Japanese population back in 1950 was 21.3. In 1995, that increased to just under 40 years, and today it's just under 50 years. So you can see that curve is pretty steep.
Yep.
Got it. Thanks, Bill. Chris Mayo. Unmuting. Now, there's a rule. Yes. You know.
Yep, I got it. Hit myself off beat.
You remember the rule? It started like at the second or third briefing that if anybody has to be told to unmute three times, you owe everybody a drink. So just so you know the rule. But you're
all
good.
Right.
You're good.
I only had once. So, and maybe this is just because of my own personal experience. As a group, have you guys seen changes in behavior among international family offices? Like, I've been doing a lot of work with Canadian family offices, and the way they've invested in the U.S. has been greatly curtailed since the one big beautiful bill has come in. I mean, there's a lot more tax leakage. Some of that may be geopolitical.
Since Bill's just up, Bill, are you there still?
Yes, I'm still here.
Because, you know, we're due to have another survey. And now we have digital. We have digital. So we have the attention of more people. We could, because that's all about data, right? Like you and I could talk. Like I know a lot of Canadians are in the Hamptons right now and no change. But there's more like, I'd say, retail level. But I don't know at the family office level. So it'd be better. I'd rather not be anecdotal. But does anyone have any data on this point? I mean, you're part of a Canadian family office group, Stephen.
Yes, I am.
Any?
I don't have any insights in it. I think there is a lot of focus on Canada for the wealthy Canadian families right now. I think they're talking about dealing with some of their big issues, and I think they see some big opportunities inside the country still. But they have their own work. They have a lot of wood to chop in Canada right now with their economy. So I think a lot of money staying there right now, Mark, from what we're hearing.
Keith, because you live closer to the Canadian border, you have a view on this?
Yeah, I'm a dual Canadian-U.S. citizen. But what I wanted to just call out is this is a really interesting conversation, similar to the conversation that just happened on the VC channel, which is what VCs are active, what are they doing, what are the metrics, et cetera, and you might want to have like a family office channel to discuss this because I think that Christopher raises a good point. As I approach Canadian family offices for funding for my companies, it's changed in the last couple of years in terms of what they're investing in and what their focus areas are. And so that would be extremely helpful to the group to know where various family offices in various regions, for instance, Walter and I have been talking a lot about Brazil, are basically spending money on what tech.
Would you come to Toronto?
Absolutely.
We have a Toronto event in the making in October late.
Yeah, I spent 3.5 years working for IBM in Toronto. I'm happy to go back.
Mark, we don't have the museum anymore.
I know. There was this museum. It was beautiful. Had the oldest Mercedes or Benz, I can't remember which, also every Air Jordan made in Toronto. But no, we have other. I think we're going to go back 2018 or 17. We went to the Fairmount and sort of feels good to go back.
I don't know, Mark. Four Seasons down in downtown. Perfect spot.
We'll go with the winds of the universe. So wherever you guys guide us, we'll go. But it feels good to.
And I just want to add, Stephen just put it in the chat, but if you have not been to the Hockey Hall of Fame, it is a must stop if you're in Toronto. It's walk in off the street in downtown Toronto. It is fascinating. Right.
So we did get we had a tour of the stadium where the Raptors played there. They showed how the hockey rink changes within like hours. Mm-hmm. To the stadium.
Go Oilers.
There you go. All right. I'm looking at you, Rich Sobel, of hockey for some reason. I think of you in hockey.
I've been to the Hall of Fame just to say
you'll vouch. Any other comments, questions before we break? And again, that I did want to underscore, I don't think it's too much to ask. You tell me. I want to help our community grow. That takes a team. And we've been doing this for all these years and for nothing. So I love it. And now many of you, thank you that are joining in. There's 361 levels and 961 levels for more users and features, trying to keep it accessible. But yeah, we would like to grow. And if we could have, we want to make sure, what was it Walter said, that people are still nice. So we'll try to keep that rule, however you define it. It's our culture. If, you know, we've only banned 5 people and I'd like to ban more, but I guess we'll ban them by they're voting with not signing up. I'm too nice, I've been told. But this is the time to know who wants to support our growth, and we'll support everybody together. We'll be stronger together. And I thank everyone, whether you've been to one of these or, I don't know, we were tracking this before Bill Deichler, now we'll be able to track everything digitally. I think, obviously Stephen's been to 279 of the 281, maybe 278. The Cal Ripken, my grandfather never missed a day for 34 years of factory work at Owens Corning. But Stephen,
that's a lot harder than this. Let's just be clear. This is every Tuesday. That was every day. Give your grandfather credit.
Stephen does have a team, which you don't see behind him. But you did this in the middle of COVID, right?
In the middle of COVID too, though.
You did. It was, you know, you called it. You know, you missed the call on Russia invading Ukraine. Fine. I missed it too. There were 6 scenarios, and no one chose the 6th.
I think we all missed it, Mark, except for me.
Okay. You back to data. I want to see the data on that. Well, we have a new person with a question with their hand up, so I just in respect, Malia.
Sorry. Thanks, Mark. Stephen, I have a quick question regarding stable coins. Obviously, we know when the Fed cuts rates, that collapsed the bond market last year, but then we have this Genius Act that has an insatiable amount of buying demand treasuries. Could that be something that's actually helped the Fed to lower rates, even though we are worried about a melt-up scenario? And obviously, global M2 supply is picking up so much that's actually aiding this risk asset rally?
I think it will help the Treasury by increasing demand for treasuries that would not have them have to push rates up as much. If they get in a spot where the markets, the bond vigilantes are acting up, if you have more demand coming from a new source like stablecoin, that could actually create a new buyer, which will allow the supply and demand to be in better balance. I think the issue is going to be, what maturities are they buying the stablecoins at, and how does that help the long end of the market?
It does sort of help the back end a bit, right? Since this Genius Act came in, which is alleviating the bond market concerns. Yep. Thank you for your comments.
But there are also people on the call who are much more knowledgeable about stable coins and crypto than I am. So I would let them, Bill or somebody else, if they want to weigh in.
Let me go to that point. That's many, many years. Where we started with 361 was from alumni networking. And the alumni networking started with 7 people, 5 of whom were Chinese in New York City students. And they said, it'd be nice to meet other alumni. So next year we went to like 25 people. Fast forward, we had 300 people. And as you grew from 30 to 70, we had to go into round tables. In New York City, it was marketing, fashion, and finance. And then the rest, I stuck with the rest, kept growing. And that's really where we're going back to are these circles. Instead of on LinkedIn and everyone else, is so that you can, if you're in crypto, we've just identified we're not going to start a circle unless we have 10 real allocators to start that circle, because that's what you want, right? Same thing with alumni. Early alumni didn't want to be with other students. They wanted to be with alumni from the 70s and 60s that actually could mentor them. In this case, it's those who can invest in that, who can really write a check and know the space. right? So that's really where we're going to with our shift, and as I'm hearing what you're coming from. But we need all layers. You need people who are young and hungry, people who are maybe fund managers or maybe smaller family offices will lean in more than the large ones. And the large ones will, you know, we had Todd Rupert today, so we, you know, earlier, and, you know, Alan Patrickoff will come in. So hopefully they want to be in places that are relevant. Alan wants to be in longevity, right? I'm looking at Susan's, you know, that very ambitious goal with the Amazon thing, but, you know, you're in real estate, right? Let's just get the real estate people with the real estate. Let's get the ag people with the ag people. Emerging markets with Leslie, and, you know, supply chain dual use with JP, and, you know, the university tech players with Spencer. You know, and how do we figure out LATAM? We have Adam. You know, Bill, you can do everything, so you get to play in every circle. I mean, Jason's playing a unique role in India, but he's also involved with hedge funds. He's involved with credit. He's involved with venture investing for the family. You have all four vectors. Instead of a PowerPoint and saying, okay, what industries, what asset classes, what geographies are you coming from, and what are your profiles? Because that's the other point. If you are a family office, you want to be together. If you're a fund manager, you might have an affinity group among fund managers. You just want to be with real people. And I, you know, there are people here on this Zoom, love them, might like people, but they're not doing anything, right? Well, they can contribute in some way that we'd love to have them on. But everybody wants to know who is real. And that's what I'm, you know, and we're going to be asking as you join, you know, if you're, as you go higher, we want to make sure you're real. And we're going to be asking for references. Because it's just a waste of time to spend, and not only waste of time, you could be associated with some bad actors, and who needs that? So we do background checks, but we want to do stricter background checks. All that takes a little bit of money. So I'm just asking everyone to ante in so we can enhance the quality of everything we're doing, and it'll be a lot more useful time for everyone involved. Darren, you have a hands up in the queue.
Yeah, I just want to echo on that. So it's been, very insightful to participate in on Tuesdays. Also on deep dives, was able to learn, you know, a lot of things on different subjects.
We can do many more, Darren, now.
Yeah, connect with many people very quality people across the globe, so it was a very good decision to be part of it. So that's what I want to echo with, like, for example, deep dives venture capital discussion that we are having recently, like the potential the Oxford type of debate. I think all of that are extremely value added things, and as people discuss and see their each other and talk, they know and remember more than
LinkedIn. Point about you, Zarin? This is actually something that Yasmin made, is we want to do revenue sharing. If you bring us a member, 361 member, 961, you get 30%. This, if you bring on a 10K plus member, you get 50%. We want to grease the wheels of the growth. Second, sometimes people originate, some people chaperone. This is where you need better technology, blockchain or otherwise. This is something that Zarin's been a part of. It's called multi-point attribution models. So as I look around, you know, I can't remember who introduced me to David, or I guess Jason, who introduced me to you and Parth. But whoever originates these relationships, that's great. I mean, you should get some credit. But if suddenly Adam chaperones Jason to a deal, maybe not a deal because I can't share success fees, but I can share almost everything else. An equity success fee, I cannot. But we want to reward real origination, real chaperoning, because that's how you grow a community. We don't want to do this by randomness. We want to do it through warm relationship chains. Sorry. And that's something that you've been focused on, Zarin, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Been a pleasure. and you know, all this discussion on the VC and some of the points and mistakes, like with Joe, for example, I had introduced him to the group, and he has been an incredible source
of coordinator for Joe, right?
Information. Yes, but I also learned so much from Joe. So it was, yes, last night we had a nice discussion as well. So yeah, definitely looking forward to for this whole venture group
Joe
coming
provides
together.
A great service. He provides a service to Lucid, for example, that works out, you know, Jay, you know, he makes these, he has a service that for like roughly $400, he puts you into a stakeholder report. He disciplines you and he gets you ready for people like or groups like us to get involved, and they have a track record, so you can look back. So if he has an accounting irregularity, you'll know it. It's not audit, but it's reporting. And you know, and Joe charges, and you know, I've never done it, but we've always said we could take a little bit of the referrals, and you should get a piece of that, Zarin. That's the way we want this all to work.
Yeah, and it's a very good quality work. Again, I'm not being paid by Joe or Mike until now, no. But and it's not a lot, this monthly thing for startups, because sometimes my heart goes out to startups.
Darren,
you
can give
like,
it to charity, but you deserve it. That's
yeah.
What I'm
no, thank you, but yeah, very good.
Keith,
I love the idea of valuing and validating the community, Mark. I think you're on the right track. I think that's the right thing to do. And I appreciated reading the note that you sent out to a few people, yesterday. And there's some questions in the chat about doing that. Separately, I just wanted to call out the fact that, Toronto is an interesting venue, but if you watch your social channel and if you watch even what's in chat right now, Cape Town is a evolving opportunity. A lot of people are going down there for the arts. A lot of people are going down there to try and stimulate the Africa community. A lot of people are going down there for philanthropy and technology. So Cape Town is, I think, something you should consider in terms of a venue for one of your events.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's interesting that but this is where we want more real-time feedback of where to go. If you don't know me, you know, if you make it easy for us to do it, we'll do it in Cape Town. Just, you know, help. I need a venue. I need a some really interesting speakers to kick off. Actually, we have Launch Africa. Zachariah is there, one of our funds. Todd Rupert is very active. And so we can just sort of create a little circle, 360, create Cape Town. But we want it to lead to something, too. Doesn't have to be transactional right away. We want it to, like, let's find interesting funds and interesting companies, founders to work with.
Well, let's do a Friends of South Africa or Friends of Cape Town channel, and let's have this conversation.
All right. You'll have it right away, but you just have to be a member. Susan, you asked about the or someone who asked about the revenue sharing.
It's me.
You're the first to receive that document.
Okay, that's what it is. Okay, I got it.
But well, you'll see, everyone, you'll see we're happy to share. If we do an onboarding, we do a retainer, we do a sponsorship and an event, it's like a 20% rule. If I can get you on the other side, if I can get you a gig as a CIO or in a consultant to vet a deal, we like 20%. So it's with products, it doesn't. If you're a commodities and you're doing a trade on copper, you know, then there's like $3 a ton. Then, you know, it's a percentage of the profit. But it's the same concept. If it's relating to membership, I mentioned it already. We'll go higher. If you're a banker, then we share 50 or 60 to the cap intro bankers. That's how syndications world works. So we're happy to share. But mainly what we're really looking for are really great, real allocators at the top by the segments. So when Tim Draper says, I want to be part of it, well, I have to be relevant for him, but he has to be relevant for us. So he knows digital, he knows venture, he knows too many things probably. I was just going to stack the deck at the top. Whoever can bring me, not him, but anyone equivalent or anyone that's real, will, and they pay a fee, will share it with everyone. And it can continue with accountability if those people end up doing other things. And if you want to become a banker, it's not that hard either. 361firm.com/bankers. Take two tests. Could be the 79 or the 82 or the full 7 and then the 63 if you're in the U.S. And if you want to bring money to firms like ARS, it's a 65. It's not that hard. You guys can do it.
I'm currently sponsored and neck deep in Kaplan, so give me 3 months, Mark.
Who is this?
Silberberg, Michael.
Oh, Michael. Yeah.
Doing the 7 and
7. I got thrown into the deep end like my father taught me how to swim. Well, our, my family office, we invested into a bank, and they showed up, and the compliance says, you've got your licenses. Well, no, I haven't done that in a while, and I had to go crash course on it. Wait till you do the 24. Charles, Samir.
Yeah, so I just, first of all, Mark, this is a great community, obviously. And I think one of the things that's really exciting about what you're doing right now is I think there's a lot of unleveraged resources amongst the people that are in here, right? Both in terms of expertise, but also, I mean, obviously capital, but expertise as well in certain spaces, which I think, could be much better leveraged. And hopefully this will be a good forum for that. So, it's pretty exciting, obviously, the direction you're taking this.
The whole talent part was part of a lived experience, being with the family office, looking at 1,000 deals. The deals we did were because of the people. Somebody helped us gave us an edge on the deal. Could have been a contract, could have been, or just don't do that deal because this is a bad deal. So vetting and hiring those people, finding the specialists, and I don't know if Eddie Vonderpark's on the call, but we found a head of gasification from Shell, former, to look at something he invested in. But the idea is you don't need me. I want to move beyond me being the person who knows that person. So it all just happens. Like, you have such expertise. I mean, you'll do some of it just because you're what comes around goes around. But there's some real, you know, I'm sure you have venture advisors on your bench that could be useful for others. And you could be helpful to them if you could find other gigs, perhaps. So, yeah, that's the idea. Some of the CIOs, you know, here on this Zoom, they're like Tom Brady's playing a run game, not be able to flex their muscles. And they're bored. Life's too short. Samir.
So Mark, had a you know, great, you know, great direction here. On 361firm.digital, right? You have the membership, I guess you have the member login button. And, you know, when I click on that, it doesn't give you the option to kind of, you know, get into the member portal yet. So is there sort of a date by which
you got an email this morning? You had logged in with, whatever email that you became a member with.
Got it.
And that's it. You know, a lot of people have so many emails, but if you have an issue, I should put in the chat, Yasmin, and her team will be part of, you know, your success team, starting September 1, and you can follow up. I'm definitely not your success team. I'm a connector team. Adam's laughing at me. I mean, I am part of
laughing with you, Mark. Laughing with you.
Thank you. It has been great working with people who are neurodiverse that are really focused. I think that's going to be good for everybody involved. Other questions before we wrap?
Mark, I have to drop, but great success. Onward, forward. Very excited.
Period. Very good.
Thanks, Mark. Have a great Labor Day, everyone.
Thank you. Yes, you too, Stephen.
Thank you. Thank you.
Take care.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Susan.
Mark, let's set a time for me and you and Yasmin.
Yes.
And thanks.
I'll throw a link, or I'll just put it, connect us in a group. Cool. I want a rematch. Oh, he left. I'm too competitive. I didn't play tennis in a year, and I lost to Pitch Sobel. And I'm recording this even worse.